Welcome to the B-Side, episode number 16, it's February 18th, it's a podcast of Tuas Lights Church. My name is Rhoda, and I'm back as your host today with Stephen Croker.
Hey.
And Tyler Crawford.
Yoda.
Awesome. I think we just started something
Yoda
there.
Yoda is not here.
Yoda.
Who's Yoda?
Yeah. Did you just ask who Yoda is?
I'm just kidding. I'm just trying to poke our
Yeah, sure he is. Okay, so who's Yoda?
It's that guy from Star Trek? Star Wars? One of those two. I've never seen either of them.
Do we restart this podcast for Tyler's sake?
Ian Staunton just threw his phone.
Yeah, Ian Staunton was going to send something into us.
Angry email.
We celebrate our differences. We're Canadian.
So that intro song is not by who I think it is, but I keep thinking that it's going to start into, like, the tune of that. It's going to start into, like, going on up to the spirit of the sky. So if you were listening to the podcast and you thought it was going to go into that song, that's not what it's from. Just made me think that. I think they stole the intro from that. Okay, so we got some good questions and good thoughts today on the B-side. But I thought I'd have a little fun with the guys. They just know this now, that I was in the States with my niece and... Actually, I was in the States with my niece. I was in the States myself, and I bought this bag of chips because I thought, wow, that is a really fascinating flavor. And then I had my niece try them, and I said, I got to take these to work. And she goes, you should – it was her idea. She said, you should have them try them and try to guess what the flavor is. So this is a shout-out to my niece, and we're going to do that. I said, I'll do that on the podcast. You can eat chocolate but not chips. Are you more coffee? Sweet guy than a savory guy?
I'm both.
Okay, so...
Did you just turn the B-side into a game show?
No. To my personal game show.
What do we
show.
Win?
Okay, just try one. Don't stick your head in the bag. Just try a chip. Okay. I should have a prize for whoever gets it closest.
Oh, I know what it is.
You know what it is?
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
It's either like curry or butter chicken.
Nope. Butter chicken chips might be good, though.
Chicken Steve? And waffles.
How do you know that?
Yeah.
How do you know that? It is chicken. You saw the bag? You're such a cheater. You ruined my game.
Have you ever actually had chicken waffles?
No, but look at that. On the front of this Lay's bag, it's disgusting.
That's horrible.
Chicken and waffles is like a staple in the South.
Yeah, but it's like they put it into a flavor of chips. They were on sale. There might be a reason for that. But I was like, I have to.
Yeah.
I know I'm not a big fan.
It's very confusing.
It tasted kind of like
But I could
go. You chase the maple syrup first.
But here at 10 in the morning, 11 in the morning, I could really go for a waffle. Next week, just bring a waffle.
Yeah. For some reason,
just bring a waffle.
Or pancakes. I also could. I'd be okay.
Okay, so I bought these chips. I thought this was totally bizarre. And then I was at IHOP on the weekend, and I look on the menu, and guess they have fried chicken and waffles on the IHOP menu. I was like, what?
It's a super popular dish. When I was at
neither of which is good for you.
No, yeah. Well, that's the
like a side of broccoli with that.
Isn't that the motto in the southern United States?
Add chicken.
It's not good for you, but deep fry it.
This meal needs.
I'm sure you guys have heard of Waffle House, which is like a all day breakfast joint. That's like, you've never heard of Waffle House?
No.
Oh, it's unreal. It's just like a Waffle House. It's a
shocking
name. But they're all over the States, mostly in the southern belt. So I was in Kentucky a couple years ago for a conference, and then I was in Indianapolis a bit later. And these guys from Atlanta were there that we became friends with, these other youth workers, and they took us to Waffle House, and it changed my world. It was so good. It was like IHOP, but better. But they were like, chicken and waffles is like a staple. Like, it's a southern, especially in, like, Georgia, Florida, like, it's like...
You know, I can't mock this
like
because...
It's like cultural, like, collard greens or, like, grits,
I thought this was
like,
so... I thought this was so bizarre. But then, like, we were just discussing, like, the fact... I'm the first Canadian born in my family. And my family comes from the land where they deep fry Mars bars. And, like, my gran came to visit me when I was a kid. And she goes, do you want a sandwich? And I'm like, sure. So she took two pieces of white bread, put butter in them, and then put a Kit Kat in between the two pieces of white bread.
Really?
Yes, chocolate bar sandwich. It's actually surprisingly really good, but not good for you. That was my gran gave me that. No wonder they have like the highest rate of heart disease.
I mean, you go to Texas, right? Like, my mom, I got a cousin who lives in Texas, but I guess my mom and dad were down there for her wedding, and my mom just tells me stories like, put deep fried in front of any food you've ever seen, and it'll be on a menu there.
Like, oh, that's like the UK.
Deep fried kiwi, deep fried butter, deep fried chocolate, like deep fried banana. I'm like,
deep fried turkeys.
Whatever happened to just eating a banana? Like, why do you gotta bread it and deep fry it? And make it clog your arteries.
Get off the tree.
Anyway, all right. Well, there was my experimentation that Steve totally cheated on this morning.
You showed it to me.
I didn't mean to show you that side of it.
I don't
poor product placement.
Don't recommend chicken and waffles.
This episode.
No, we don't. We don't endorse this chip flavor.
But
I like
Lay's. Would endorse. Have you ever had there's a chicken wings one that's pretty good and a like loaded baked potato flavor.
Those make more sense in my mind.
Yeah.
There's less meal confusion.
Yeah.
I'm not even a food separatist, but I find that I like sweet and salty. Like, I love that Chicago
like
mix popcorn. The one that has the cheddar and the caramel together, that is really good. But that's not like that's not throwing a meat in
you
there.
You got to get the Costco.
Right? Like, we're not now throwing, like,
well, it's one thing. The thing is like, in one sense, not to beat this to death, chicken and waffles, you can actually make a bit of logical sense to it, because it's waffles in and of themselves aren't necessarily super sweet. They're more of a breaded kind of carbohydrate with meat. But when you add syrup and whipped cream like we do, it sounds disgusting. But so that makes in my head chicken and waffles. It's not something I would put together, but I'm like, I can see it in a sense.
Yeah, but this flavor of chips is definitely maple syrup's like the first
taste. But then you add syrup and potato flavoring, it's kind of like, yeah, boat's gone.
So, Steve, I heard a lot, just in the last day, I've heard a lot of good feedback about Sunday's sermon and people connecting with it about the most important passage, or people quoting it as the most important passage in the Bible, of the one of really getting, of the real need to realize the grace of God in our lives. That's like the main point of glorifying God. And am I totally like,
was
totally
there a question there?
That?
Sorry.
No, but I just didn't know if you're okay with how I phrased
yeah,
that.
Sure.
But and so I'm just going to throw this out to people. I was there's a blog by Anne Voskamp. She wrote 1,000
Gifts.
And so a lot of people know who she is. She's a creative writer. She's very artsy in her writing. But she had written this blog on gratitude, and it talks about her and her family. They had obviously gone to Haiti. They were working in the streets, collecting garbage, working in the neighborhoods. And she was commenting on how there were no girls around because that they do other things with girls, and how this the impact on her family. And as she's having this experience, she thought of a quote from Gloria Steinem. And for those of you, many of you listening probably know who Gloria Steinem is, but if you don't, she's an American feminist, a journalist, a social and political advocate who really came into the spotlight in the 60s and 70s. And she has some famous quotes about fire in the belly doesn't come from gratitude, and also that gratitude never radicalized anybody. And what I love about this blog, and I just read it in listening to your sermon, is Anne responds to it and basically is then fire in the belly and the bones and fire in the body blazes from gratitude for grace. And it talked about radical grace. So grace never fails to radicalize the radically grateful. And when you're radically grateful for what you have, you will go to radical lengths to share it. When you're radically grateful for being blessed, you are radically generous to the oppressed. And when you're overwhelmed with the goodness of God to you, you overflow with the goodness of God to others. You can't know grace and not be moved. Grace is a catalyst that makes you an activist, evangelist, and revivalist. So she's just kind of contradicting this Gloria Steinem thing of, like, actually, if you've experienced radical grace, it should create a radical response in your life. And I just thought that was interesting in reading through that and listening to your sermon, because you talk about in your sermon how we think we live by good standards, so we often are missing the point that we need God's grace. But then I think even another step forward, that many of us go, oh yeah, I need God's forgiveness so that I can go to heaven, and we experience our basic understanding of, oh, this is how the formula works, I need God's grace, but we don't reflect on the magnitude of the mm-hmm. situation and the magnitude of what that grace is for us, what's been done for us. And if we realize the radical grace that's given to us, it should induce from us a response that fits that. And I wonder if that, to me, often feels like what we compartmentalize and what's often missing for us.
I think part of that is as in recent years, maybe last generation or so, we've really seen a downplaying of the biblical doctrine of judgment, hell, and the anger of God. We don't, and I get it, we don't like these concepts, the thought that God might be angry, that there, people will be punished for their sin, that there's an eternal separation from God. So, not wanting to talk about those things and afraid that maybe non-Christians would hear about these things and find it offensive or a big stumbling block. And we want to present the gospel in the most compelling way so we don't lead off with...
You're going to hell.
You're going to hell, sort it out. But a downplaying of these ideas has led to a downplaying in our a diminishing of our understanding of God's grace.
It's almost an apathy toward grace, in a sense, I would say,
Because she says, one thing she says, real gratitude doesn't make you apathetic. It makes you a real activist. But I'm thinking many of us are apathetic, you know, like, or have those times in our lives when we...
Tim Keller tells this story about why do we talk about sin? Why do we think... So, a friend's house sitting for you while you're away, and when you come back, your friend said, oh, a bill came and I paid it. But you don't know how to respond to that until you know what bill came. What debt did you pay? Hmm. Was it, a letter came and postage was due? Remember when back when they used to do this and there wasn't enough postage, so he owed 10 cents and he paid the post office and got the letter for you? And in that, which case you go, oh, thanks. Yeah, that's great. And you don't really need to respond much beyond a simple thank you. Or did he, like, pay your mortgage? Mm-hmm. Right? There's a big difference in how you respond based on the magnitude of the debt that your friend paid on your behalf and said, I just want to, out of love, I just want to cover this for you. Was it 10 cents and he covered some postage? Was it he paid your hydro bill for the month? Or did he just pay off your $500,000 mortgage? You react differently in those situations. And so when we never talk about sin and we never think about the anger of God or hell or the judgment of God, we begin to think that the grace that God has extended is for, like, covering our postage. In which case, we're a little bit grateful. Hey, that's great. Nice of God to cover our debt. But it's as we probe into and think about and come to realize the depth of our sin and the debt that we owe and what we really deserve that we begin to realize to what extent we've been forgiven. So the more you... When you've experienced this, understood this, the more we think about sin, it should lead us into a deeper and deeper gratitude. Mm-hmm. And so in trying to make Christianity more palatable and not talking about sin and anger and hell and judgment, we've actually made God's glory diminished in our own view, not in reality, and because we don't realize the grace, how great it is. And so we have a really stunted view of God's grace.
And I think a big part of that is that, especially in the West, I would imagine, we don't have a good understanding of our separation from God. We don't. There's not too many people that, like, and I think you mentioned this on Sunday, that that don't think of themselves as a good person. Mm-hmm. I'm a good person. You know, I was thinking about this guy I was talking to at the gas station a couple of weeks ago. Same gas station I always go to, and we've gotten to know each other a bit, and we chat every time I'm in there, and shared my faith with him a bit. But we were chatting about my job. I had just started here and was telling him I was a new pastor, and oh, that's great. And he kind of asked me a question about, oh, how do you kind of maintain this perfect lifestyle? And I said, I don't. That's what I have Jesus for. Like, I can't maintain a perfect lifestyle. I'm not a perfect guy. Like, I'm fallible. I make mistakes, but God loves me and died for me. And he said, he kind of made a comment, like, trying to agree with me, but essentially saying, like, you know, like, I feel like I'm putting quarters into two piggy banks. He didn't say this, but, like, the good piggy bank and the bad piggy bank. And as, so long as there's more quarters at the end of the day in the good piggy bank than the bad piggy bank, I'm going to be all right. And I just kind of had to go, and I just said, well, the great thing with Jesus is there's no piggy banks. Like, there's one piggy bank. It's full of bad quarters. And he, you know,
takes and he gives it. You his piggy bank.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the beauty of the gospel. But I think part of the hard reality of understanding, like, sin and grace is that we have been rationalizing our separation from God as a culture for so long that, you know, oh, I'm a drug addict, but I'm not hurting anybody. Or, you know, love the sinner, hate the sin. We haven't been able to do very well. We either hate the sinner and hate the sin, or we love the sinner and love the sin. Mm-hmm. And so we
accept the sin. Yeah. I was thinking it's actually, you followed up on it in your sermon, but it's a conversation I had the other week with someone as well, where we are not comfortable with God's judgment. We're not comfortable with him. We're okay with God's. We get mad if God doesn't extract justice in the world, but we're only comfortable as long as it doesn't apply to us.
Yep.
Right? As soon as it applies to us, it's totally unfair. And I'm like, that's such juvenile thinking,
actually. We feel it's perfectly acceptable for us to judge God.
Yeah.
How could God let this happen? So we're judging God's behavior and going, that wasn't good. Like, how could God allow evil? So we're going to judge him, but then the thought of him judging us is, like, horrifying and offensive. It's like, okay, hang on. Who's God and who's not?
Yeah.
So a lot of people have placed themselves in the judgment seat. So I'm going to evaluate and judge God and see if he fits my standards. But then the thought that the rules might be reversed is just to be rejected.
Yeah.
And then we get mad if he doesn't exact justice on other people.
Yeah.
But he can't do it to us because we're good people. Yeah. And it gets messed up. I love that in Sunday school right now, I've been subbing in a little bit, and they're doing the prophets. Like, not terribly – I love this curriculum because it doesn't, like, skip over and gloss over things. But they've been doing prophets. Well, the prophets' jobs were to bring the word of the Lord to the people and tell them
you're sinning. Sometimes get totally naked.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
We might have skipped that part of Isaiah school. But,
that's a good part of Isaiah.
I don't actually know the answer to that. But to call out people and tell them you're sinning. And if you don't turn around and repent – then there'll be discipline that's brought. There'll be judgment that's brought.
Yeah.
And then, but people always read everything in little context. They read the, like, oh, God had the Assyrians or the Babylonians come in and do this to the people. And you think, how could God do that? They haven't looked at all at the patience of the Lord in waiting and asking for them to turn around and warning them.
Hundreds of years.
Hundreds of years.
This is the key point and what I was trying to interject with earlier, but I was listening to a sermon this week where the preacher was kind of bringing up scenarios like this and saying, like, you know, how can God ... How could a good God allow this, that, or the other? And I was just like, I know this for myself to be true, but I hadn't heard it so kind of clearly defined. And it was essentially, it was like, we did this. This is not on God. Whatever evil, whatever thing that you want to finish that sentence with, how could God allow a child to die in a car accident? How we allowed as a human race sin to enter the world, God's perfect creation, and sin has now weeded itself into every corner of our culture and world so that terrible things happen, and it's a result of sin.
Mm-hmm.
And the result of sin is us. It's on us.
Yeah.
It's you. It's not God. Stop blaming God for our... And I just thought, like, for me, that was really helpful to think about going, like, yeah. Like, the reality is I might sometimes want to point the finger at God and say, how could you? Where very often I will point the finger at myself and say, how could I?
Hmm.
And I think that's a big transition as a culture, you know, as a church, that we should be pointing the finger at looking at ourselves and saying, how could I, God, give me grace?
Mm-hmm.
Much more often than we should be saying,
and then the question, God, is, like,
how could the Amalekites get slaughtered? Like,
how does that radical grace then, like, it's one thing to acknowledge that it's radical grace, and if you really understand that, then what does our response to that radical grace look like? Like, I think of the kids that we're teaching in Sunday school, I think of the next generation, and I'm like, if we don't exude radical worship, and I don't mean just singing, like, it's not just worship as we know, it's not tied just to our singing on Sundays, but if our lives aren't radical worship, why would the next generation understand how to radically worship God or respond to that grace? They're more excited about Santa Claus. Like, if you say Santa Claus is coming, a lot of kids would be like, right on, and they're, like, stoked for, like, a month, and they're making lists, but if you go, wow, Jesus, you know, like, is it the same response, or do they actually, and what are we, and this isn't meant to be an anti-Santa post. It's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying
perspective. Why do you hate Santa, Rhoda?
I'm just saying perspective of, But do they have that same excitement about Jesus? Mm-hmm. Do they actually understand that gift? And do we help them experience the joy of worship? Because they're not going to just figure that out on their own.
Well, and I think the point you're,
What is the point I'm trying to make?
Well, is that it's the same I feel like I'm dealing with in one sense of, like, I'm starting a series with our students on sexuality and how to, like, and dating and how to think about relationships going forward in their lives and what's God's idea with it. And as I'm studying and kind of trying to prepare, I'm going, like, this is daunting.
Mm-hmm.
Because there it's I'm going trying to go upstream in a culture that is rampantly sexual, rampantly open about every expression of that sexuality at a very young age, and this idea that it's normal, it's good, it's wholesome, and I'm trying to come back through and say, like, no, like, God has a better way for this to happen, but I have to speak louder and clearer and more passionately than the culture speaking back, because I got to combat the flow that's coming downstream. And it's the same with how we worship, I think. And like, yeah, it's not a surprise to see that kids would be excited about Santa Claus. Why? Well, when you go to the mall at Christmas time, what's center court full of? This mm-hmm. giant, fun-looking, soft, like, Santa. You know, like, if Jesus was at center court, they might be
Would it be fun? I'm not suggesting that
we. Not suggesting we put a Jesus in the center court of the mall anywhere. I'm just saying, if it was commercialized, if our faith was commercialized and packaged and dumbed down and mythologized. That might be the word we're looking for. Let's pretend somebody looked that up. Tell us if that's a word. It might be a bit easier to get kids excited because it's, but in these, all these things, we're walking upstream. So I think we have
but
to choose our words
carefully. But that's been the case of the gospel forever.
Yeah, but that's right? What I'm saying is that the point, like, we can't be at the same level as culture in our enthusiasm and our, like, culture's saturation. That's their method. Subtle saturation often. Lots of subtle messages and big sweeping gestures. Whereas
I wish you could see Tyler's body language as he talks.
Whereas I think in our faith, if you've looked, it's been radical claims in loud, not necessarily like public, popular ways, but like, look at Jesus' life. Like, he was setting a mark in the culture that he was in. And he wasn't doing it in the same way the Romans were or the Jews were or anybody. Like, he was making a difference because people were following him. And, like, and there was a clarity and a difference in what he says. Like, he wasn't a shock jock, but he also wasn't just coddling and saturating people with his subtle message of
lifestyle evangelism. Like, do we get this grace in North American cultures? And is, like, would Gloria Steinem be proved right if she were to look at a sampling of our lives? Or is the church called to action in social justice? And, like, all the things the Bible tells us to go and physically do, take our time, take our money. And I'm not just saying just humanitarian, because some churches go all that way and then they just become solely humanitarian. Mm-hmm. But with the gospel in hand, and they... but I wonder how, like, many of us don't get uncomfortable out of our, like, we don't get radical out of our radical gratitude. So I wonder if we have radical gratitude. Anyway.
Rad grad?
We need rad grad.
Rad grad.
Yeah. Maybe we can get a shirt with that.
Trademark.
Yeah. Trademark on the B-side.
Tyler Crawford Incorporated. No, not the B-sides. It's mine.
Oh.
Patent. Patent pending.
Okay. Well, but speaking of really interesting blogs, you wrote a good blog this week on Grounded that I liked.
Thank you.
Yeah. And it was in response to the author, and I always forget his name.
Donald Miller.
The author of Blue Like Jazz, which was super popular, like, just over 10 years ago, right?
Yeah, about then, yeah.
Yeah?
When we were in college at the time.
I remember it being, like, a big thing, like, oh, this great book, Blue Like Jazz, Blue Like Jazz.
Three or four it was published.
And I wasn't shocked by... because you were responding to a recent article of his, which he's basically saying, you know, I don't go to church anymore. I have a relationship with God, but church doesn't really fit my style. I don't really learn stuff there. I don't really, like, it doesn't fit my worship style. So, like, I don't do that anymore, but I still have a relationship with Jesus. And I was so disturbed. I wasn't surprised or shocked, but I was disturbed.
He said he was still in community with other Christians.
He says he doesn't learn. There's different learning styles. He's more of a hands-on learner. He doesn't learn from sermons, and he doesn't connect with God through singing. Therefore, he doesn't go to church very often because singing and sermons don't help him connect with God. He connects with God in other ways.
Which is
all about him and God, not a collective we and God, but which was part of your response.
Yes. Which is probably also the rationale of 90% of fathers that don't want to go to church with their family.
Uh-huh.
I had somebody say to me,
which made me mad.
I had one of my
because then he's posting that out there and it's like legitimizing it, and I'm like,
what am I making here, Rhodus?
Oh, sorry, Tyler.
That's what I'm getting.
Just got all passionate.
But I had one of my leaders say, like, yeah, I've heard that argument before. My dad's been saying it for 20 years. That's literally a direct quote.
In some ways, I get what he's saying. Like in my article, I said I get what he's saying. Like, I'll go to church. I don't always connect with the music. I don't connect with God through sometimes, often. That's what we hope that people connect with God through music, through singing. But sometimes you don't. And through sermons, sometimes it's like, I think one of the curses of being a preacher is it's hard to listen to some sermons because...
I'd be like a worship leader going listening to other worship
leaders. All you end up seeing is like, oh, you should have done this, should have done that. That doesn't quite follow. The image doesn't work. I know this passage so well. I know what he's going to say.
You can pick up on things when
it's
you teach
hard to just quiet yourself and listen. Anyway, so I can see why Donald Miller didn't connect with God in any way. But my point was... That's not what church is about. Like, his premise, like, the answer to Donald Miller...
Church isn't serving me.
The answer isn't better music and better sermons. It's all about Christ. Yeah. His point is that he was the first one to grow. And I'm saying, biblically, the church isn't about what we get. You'd be hard-pressed to find a passage that talks about what we can get out of a gathering. Mm-hmm. But we've fallen into this pretty typical mentality, which is church provides teaching, instruct people, and music to help them connect with God at church. But that's actually I hope that happens. That's not the time. Something than it is about doing or receiving something. And I'd say in the New Testament, there's things we're called to do. There's things that God called us to do that we can only do together. It's as hundreds of people gather and sing God's praises that we proclaim the gospel and make Jesus known through hundreds of people out of transformed hearts singing God's praise instead of their own. That's a radical thing. Which one person listening on their iPod, people have iPods anymore, iPhone, whatever.
Mm-hmm. I still have an iPod.
So, like, I listen to worship music and sing on my own. I read the Bible on my own. I read books on my own. I connect with God personally. So it's not that that doesn't matter. But as we all do that together, we're proclaiming something. We're doing something radical that glorifies God and proclaims the gospel that I could never do on my own. Mm-hmm. So church isn't about what I can get, though I hope to get something there. It's about something that we are together. And so things like as we practice church discipline, as we celebrate communion together and hundreds of people come forward and eat of the bread and drink the cup, and as we practice membership and baptism, we are proclaiming the gospel through our life together. And that's what the Bible is calling the people of God to do. It's not something about individuals. It's something what we are together. The church is the pillar and buttress of the truth. And that's why in 1 Timothy 3, that's why it matters how we behave in the household of God. So, you know, 1 Timothy letter, all about electing, you know, or not electing, but discerning elders and deacons about how you take care of the widows and about warning the rich and about how we behave and false doctrine. It's all about how we behave in the church. And Paul says the reason why he's telling Timothy how it matters why we behave is because the church is the household of God. It matters how we behave in God's house, and it's the pillar and buttress of the truth. The church is there to uphold the truth for the watching world to see, and people will see our behavior. So we are proclaiming or discrediting the gospel in how we behave in the church. That's why church discipline matters. Hmm. That's why choosing the right leaders matters. This is why how we treat each other matters, because we're either proclaiming the gospel in how we behave as a church, or we're discrediting the gospel in how we behave as a church. And we're called to make Jesus known and proclaim the gospel, uphold the truth to the watching world through being the church. So yeah, I mean, I hope people come and learn from the sermons and connect with God through the music. There's far more beautiful and glorious things going on mm-hmm. as hundreds of people sing of God's praises. So church is far more about who we are as a people than what somebody gets.
Well, and I often wonder too, like, if you take a stance like that and you go, well, church isn't for me, and I connect God better with these ways, so I'm going to design my own way, then I think, but if Jesus came back today, could you have that conversation face-to-face with him when he is clearly outlined in his word?
I like you. I don't like your bride.
Yeah,
when people,
you know,
say that to me, I fight
them.
You
know, I know you told us to do it this way, but so in case you're wondering, that's why I haven't done it. I'm like, I can't imagine having that conversation. But I think people, yeah, do not forsake the gathering.
First John 1, where is it? In First John, it talks about those who have gone out from us, and we know that they're not from us because if they were from us, they would have been with us. I'm paraphrasing. I'm probably butchering it, but there's this verse. You can look it up for me. But because they went out from us, we know
First
that they're
John?
Not from us. Yeah, I think so. So in that passage, John's saying, we know that these guys aren't really believers. They're not faithful to Jesus because they're not with us anymore. It's probably there. Bottom. Is that it there?
Yeah, here we go.
Give it a read.
Okay, so 1 John 2, verse 19. They went out from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would have continued with us. But they went out, that it might become plain that they are not all, that they all are not of us.
So what he's saying is there's some guys who are claiming the name of Christ. And maybe they're part of the community for a while, but they went out from us. They're no longer part of the Christian community, no longer part of the church, mm-hmm. John's writing to. And John says, therefore we know they're not real, they don't really belong, because if they had belonged, they would stay. So in this passage, this is really fascinating. Faithfulness to Jesus is measured by belonging to the church.
And it's not that salvation comes from going to church.
No.
But it is an evidence of your faith.
If you belong to Jesus,
yeah.
You'll belong to his people.
And
we know that they don't really belong to Jesus because they didn't stay with his people. Like, that's a pretty serious statement that
yeah.
faithfulness to Jesus will be seen through faithfulness to Jesus' people.
Which is interesting because you go back to your propitiation, you know, like it was in your sermon on Sunday that people don't use that word so much anymore. But you, so wasn't this Blue Like Jazz book at the time of kind of like the emerging church movement that happened or started just over 10 years ago?
Yeah, it was right around the same.
So you have like the emerging church, which basically is like, we love God and Jesus, but we don't believe in penal substitution.
That's part of it, yeah.
Yeah, and so like they basically took the gospel out of the church. And
some of them. That's not all lump all the emerging people. There are some,
no,
sure there's some good gospel believing people in there, but you know.
But there's
like
a lot
like
of that movement. Like now you have, you said like Rob Bell, a lot of the authors that were very popular with that movement are now basically left the church.
Yeah.
They still claim their own faith beliefs, but they're not really part of the church anymore, and a lot of that movement has died off.
In his article, Donald Miller, there's a fascinating little thing, if I remember it correctly, in that little article he wrote, or maybe it's the follow-up article he wrote, Donald Miller
Yeah, because then he backed
he
up.
He feels like, he was reminded when people responded to him to his article, like university. It was a stage he was in that he's moved beyond. Like the church is something he's moved beyond, like university. And I'm like, pretty arrogant feels. Like when
that'd be like having a family and now I've moved beyond my family.
It's disappointing. Yeah, like he's kind of moved past it now. And I think that's kind of what we've seen amongst a certain wing of the emergent movement, is that they all kind of moved beyond orthodoxy and moved beyond
the chair authority.
Okay, well,
Donald Miller's
on the note of authors, we have time just for one of our questions today, so we'll still have more to touch base on next week. So I'm going to tie today's question into what we're talking about. And we had someone saying, are there Christian authors that you could really never go wrong with reading?
Donald Miller.
That was facetious. Okay, so...
Were you thinking of that before? No, so I was like,
don't, I'm just waiting. The person who wrote this, don't go read Donald Miller. Okay, so are there some that we should...
Read him. Read some of his books.
All right.
Don't read his blog, though. Okay, so...
God Knows What is a decent read.
Okay, so... What are ones that... Well, how it was phrased was, you could never go wrong with reading... And are there some that maybe we should stay away from?
Yep.
So basically, Steve and Tyler, what are favorite authors that you would recommend books of people? And what are some books or authors that you would say, maybe don't go that direction?
Well, it's funny because Steve and I were talking about this yesterday. And I made this comment that I actually went home thinking about. And I was like, it's actually pretty true. Is start with the dead ones. Because they're not going to change where they stand.
Like Donald Miller. Like, 10 years later.
But like, you know, like... C.S. Lewis, Jonathan Edwards, like some of these guys where you can look at the whole of their of their recorded work, C.H. Spurgeon, and see, okay, like these guys were faithful to the end, to the gospel, to the orthodoxy of faith and how to live it. So these guys can be trusted. We can be, like C.S. Lewis isn't going to come out with, you know.
Contradictory.
Barely Christianity.
Barely Christianity.
The people that were passing out Velvet Elvis 10 years ago, have a little bit of egg on their face.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, hang on. Maybe that trajectory was wrong.
Right, yeah.
So in some ways, dead guys are the best ways.
It's a good place to start. Like, so I would
C.S. Lewis is a great one also, isn't it?
I mean, I wouldn't agree with everything C.S. Lewis says.
No, but he's got some good, like, Mere Christianity.
That's great.
Or Screwtape Letters. Some of these books that just kind of, there might be a bit in language, a bit up there as far as...
Well, just kinda, older style.
Older style, but... You know, they're not. Yeah, they're not necessarily going to line up theologically with everything that Steve or I or whoever might come to. But they're, I think they're trustworthy authors in the sense of their integrity and their desire to kind of proclaim Jesus.
So, Steve, name three
guys. I buy every book that comes out of there. Tim Keller.
Yeah. These are current ones, not dead ones. Authors, okay, well, first give me three dead ones.
Well, I think about dead authors is. If for a younger Christian, doesn't read a ton, it might be hard to get into.
True.
But just name
because the language is harder.
I know there's quite a few.
Yeah, I mean, they're hard. I don't know who I'd recommend. I mean, I love reading older stuff, but it's just not as accessible. Like, I know who wrote the question, and like it's just not going to be something they'd pick up is like, I mean, I'll read Luther or I'll read Spurgeon. I love Spurgeon.
Charles Spurgeon.
Charles Spurgeon's books actually are very accessible.
Yeah, they are. That's what I'm saying. There are some out there. Like, Charles Spurgeon is classic.
The only thing with Spurgeon, I find you kind of do need to read a lot of those guys at a bit of a slower pace than you would read People Magazine.
But it's rich.
Whatever. But it's not even that it's visually, it's just he writes in a kind of way. I think I've only read one of his books, Lectures to My Students. That's Spurgeon, right?
Yep.
But I just remember reading it and going like, oh, wow, I read way slower when I'm, just because the way the language is organized and how he's
But
not,
I remember being at camp, like one a program director camp, and someone coming in doing devotions for the youth staff and doing them from my utmost from his highest.
Oswald Chambers.
That's Oswald Chambers.
Oh, that's Oswald Chambers. Yeah. He's the other one. I'm like, wait, he's the other one. Spurgeon and Chambers. Spurgeon. I like Chambers.
I mean, Bunyan, John Bunyan.
So we got Pilgrim's, the least three. Bunyan, Pilgrim's Spurgeon, Chambers. Yeah. Okay, so Tim Keller, you were saying, current
ones. Living authors. Tim Keller's books are always excellent.
Okay.
John Piper, I always buy his books and benefit from them. And Jared Wilson is a younger author who I always buy his books. They're very good. J.I. Packer. He's almost dead, so that's getting there. genuinely, this guy's like almost 90.
He's like the Crypt Keeper. No, he's over 90. I'm pretty sure. I think he was 91 at Refocus that year.
Okay, so Packer, Keller.
I would say every Christian needs to read Knowing God by J.I. Packer, period. If you have not done it, sell your television. Don't watch it again until you've read Knowing God by J.I. Packer. I continue to reread it and reread it and turn back to it and reread it. And if I'm doing a sermon on, I flipped it open this week because he's got a great chapter on, it's called The Heart of the Gospel. I named my sermon after this chapter in his book on knowing that, where he talks about propitiation and explains it beautifully. His chapter on adoption being,
He's 87.
87.
So, Tyler just, my oh my came from, he just posted a current picture.
I know you love David Platt.
I do love David Platt.
Platt's great.
But his David Platt, really not so much about...
Francis Chan, his books are really accessible. Yeah, so they're really easy, right?
Yeah, like, so like if you're...
Keller and Piper would be a,
yeah, I'd say like Keller and Piper, if you're looking for like fundamental, more theology type stuff. Yep. I love David Platt but and Francis Chan for more like...
Yeah.
Yeah, but I like David Platt and Francis Chan to then challenge you of like, what does that look like? You know, like living that out.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. They're really, really practical, work it out.
Yeah, so there you go. Well, I got to wrap up today's podcast. So
yeah,
oh, you don't want to know my
there's
authors.
Lots of names there. What are your favorite and if you wanted to know what they are,
well, mine, Keller and Piper are probably my top one or two. Top one, two,
best,
maybe three.
Best Tim Keller book.
No, Reason for God by far. Yeah, it's probably, definitely. It's probably the best. Probably the most eye-opening book I've ever read in my life, in the sense of like, and this I read, I was in pastoral ministry, like I was, you know, 29 years old, 27 years old, something like that when I read it, and I was just like, the way he, like, I just found it so smart and on point and intellectual, but accessible and clearly explained. Like it's, you could be a grade 10 student, or a grade 9 student, and or you could be a you know an 85-year-old lifelong Christian with two masters and a PhD, and read this book and understand its premise, its point, and its reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that
yeah,
was
reason
probably,
for God's
so reason for God is does, is the premise is he's it's sort of an apologetic type book. He's writing to communicate the gospel to unbelievers. Tim Keller's a pastor in Manhattan. His church is packed with young, kind of more atheistic people who questioning, and these are the people he faces every day sharing the gospel with. And the book was aimed at taking on the major kind of criticisms or questions that people struggle with. How can a good God allow evil, things like that, right? And he kind of takes those on in the first half. In the second half of the book, he's trying to articulate the gospel well.
Yeah.
And he does a phenomenal job.
Yeah, and then Desiring God was probably my...
By John Piper.
Yeah, by John Piper.
That's a
another terrific book that essentially just walks through not only the gospel, but what Christianity, what the Christian life looks like in all these different aspects. Money, worship, give it, you know, like sacrifice, like suffering, like a lot of this kind of stuff that we're all going to encounter in our life, how to have a biblical perspective.
That book
on
was
it.
Massively influential for me.
Yeah.
As well as, and therefore, as well as influential in our church's understanding of worship and this, what we called for a while, passionate spirituality, a worshipful life, was heavily influenced by that, a whole idea of Christian hedonism. Another good book by John Piper for an accessible, pretty easy starting read would be Don't Waste Your Life by John Piper, where he explains the gospel. And it's really practical. It's sort of like a call to live this Christ-honoring, God-glorifying life.
The other book that I found really influential, and it's funny.
Okay, last book.
Yeah, I'm just going to mention this.
The Hero by Steve Croker.
That's a good
I haven't cracked the spine on that one yet.
No.
But I got it. It's on my bookshelf. Is I know he's kind of come under some personal issues and controversy of late. C.J. Mahaney.
Mahaney.
I don't know what he did. I can't remember. I just remember him coming up. He had done something that it wasn't good. But he wrote a book, a little pocketbook called The Cross-Centered Life.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good book. That was like pretty profound. And there's another one called The Treasure Principle by Randy Alcorn that talked like...
We have that in the foyer, I think.
Yeah, just the good kind of like Treasure Principle helped me think about money and giving and
it's a good book.
How to be generous. And Cross-Centered Life is just about how do we take this idea of the gospel and the cross and actually live it out. And they're short. They're like under 100 pages probably, but they're just deep and a good place to start.
Hey, Steve, do you think that you could... take the authors' names of the books that we just mentioned. Can we make a list of them somehow on the website? Is there a way to do that?
Yeah, put it on the news feed.
Or in Tap Connected or news
feed. Go to twosslines.org, click the news feed. This is news. It's like the third bar over. I'll write a blog, a short blog, just listing these things.
Just listing the different kind of books. Because I like that. That's a good variety between, you know, like the Tim Kellers and the Platts and the Francis Chans and then the Randy Yoka. Like, it's a good, there's kind of a good cross-section in there. So,
okay.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, thanks, guys. And check out the newsfeed for the list of books. See you next week.
See ya.